working with them, I think we have the best chance of pushing back against a lot of what China is doing.
China has a different view of trade with the United States. It's Tuesday, May 8th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, despite aid, food is scarce for Rohingya. Skepticism builds ahead of Trump-Kim summit. Afghans find a new place of worship, choosing your baby, and learning about energy from plants. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China's central bank governor, in comments released Monday, said the trade imbalance between China and the United States is structural and long-term and should be approached rationally. Yi Gang, appointed to the head of the People's Bank of China in March, told a financial magazine concerted efforts are needed by both sides to ease trade friction. His comments were published after the end of 2 days of high-level trade talks in Beijing, in which Washington reportedly demanded sharp drops of $200 billion in China's trade surplus by the end of 2020, a surplus that reached $375 billion in 2017. Yi said China's opening up would not be affected by the trade dispute, in which the United States has proposed tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese goods, and Beijing vowing to retaliate. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Texas Republican Mac Thornberry, told Fox News Sunday the United States will need other countries in its dispute with Beijing.
A lot of countries are very concerned about Chinese trade practices. And working with them, I think we have the best chance of pushing back against a lot of what China is doing. One example in the defense world is China is stealing and obtaining through all sorts of ways critical intellectual property that they are going to use for their defense purposes. We have to close the door on that. What I worry about is that the steel and aluminum tariffs have alienated some of our friends that we need to work with to push back against the Chinese trade tactics. To be more effective, we've got to have allies.
China and the United States ended their trade talks with what Beijing called big differences. Peter Morisi, economics professor at the University of Maryland, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the talks did not go well.
The Americans laid out our problems, and the Chinese are unresponsive. They believe they've surpassed us and don't have to pay attention to us, that they've beaten us at the game.
Have they?
Well, only if we let them. We have lots of options. The question is, do you have the courage to take them? Anything we do would be costly. But sometimes you have to do costly things. It's really a choice. Do we want to learn Chinese or do we want to be sovereign?
Is President Trump the man to do what you say needs to be done?
I don't know. You know, one of the things that you do when you don't want to do something in Washington is you say it's illegal. He's going through this elaborate Kabuki dance on punitive tariffs, basically saying they're in retaliation for the piracy of intellectual property. Richard Nixon, when faced with a dollar problem, put an across-the-board tariff in place. He ran on an across-the-board tariff, that is, Donald Trump did. And if you think it's crazy, remember that Mitt Romney advocated the same thing. That would be very difficult for China to retaliate. I would put in place something more elaborate, an across-the-board quota system. Basically, I would give licenses to exporters. If you send a dollar of goods to China, you get a license to import a dollar, and those licenses would be resellable. Then if the Chinese retaliated, it would actually further reduce their exports to the United States. And if they bought more of our stuff, it would create more licenses and more opportunities to export to the United States. Now, if it was legal for Mr. Nixon, it's legal for Mr. Trump. But the Trump people are going around town saying it's not legal. I'm starting to think that the Trump people don't have the courage of conviction.
You wrote an article at the time of the trade talks titled How China Has Targeted U.S. Industries. What was the premise of your article?
Well, the basic premise is that we really can't do business with China. It's developed its economy by specializing in loopholes in the WTO. The WTO is inadequate for the West, not just the United States, but the Europeans as well for dealing with China, because it's a set of rules for market economies, and it penalizes venial sins of subsidizing too much and this and that. In their bones, the Chinese don't believe in markets, so they really can't be in a market economy. It's like a criminal at loose in a Mormon town. I mean, if he really doesn't believe that people should be civil and nice to each other, he's going to rob them blind until they catch him and lock him up.
Peter Morici said his across-the-board quota system will hurt both sides, but the Chinese more, and that could force them to come to reason. He said China sends $500 billion in goods to the United States, but America only sends $150 billion in its goods to China. That, he said, gives the U.S. leverage in the dispute. Morici said if President Trump believes trade wars can be won, it's time he shows us how. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOANews.com. Reports say Singapore likely site of U.S.-North Korea summit. China and Indonesia discuss ways to boost trade relations. Bootleg liquor, not water, killed Cambodian villagers. China slams U.S. criticism of its Orwellian Taiwan demand. Analysts say UN Security Council Myanmar visit is one small step. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, also at our voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. In refugee camps in Bangladesh, Rohingya refugees from Myanmar face high levels of malnutrition, despite a large presence of aid organizations on the ground for over 8 months. Aid workers are providing hot meals and treating malnourished children, but mothers in the camps need more support to keep their children well fed. For VOA, Jason Patinkin reports from malnutrition clinics and refugee camps in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar district.
Every morning, this kitchen produces thousands of meals for Rohingya refugees now living in Bangladesh. These refugees arrived in Bangladesh last year in destitution. Many were starving after fleeing for days to escape army attacks on their villages. But nearly 9 months later, even with regular food distributions, hunger is still a problem for the refugees, who number over 700,000. So, many families depend on the hot meals distributed here by the Action Against Hunger aid group. Abdu Sobi says he comes almost every day with his brother's children.
I need money to buy fish, vegetables and chili to cook. I don't have this. Where will I get it? So I brought my children here because they give food for free, and when we leave, they give us biscuits.
But the free lunches are not enough to keep everyone healthy. One-fifth of Rohingya children in the camps are malnourished, according to Action Against Hunger. In this clinic alone, there are 120 undergoing treatment for severe acute malnutrition each week. This mother, named Roshida, has brought her six-month-old daughter in for treatment. The clinicians measure the baby's arm and determine she has the severe form of malnutrition.
She was breastfeeding for 2 months, and now I cannot produce enough milk, so she became malnourished. I cannot produce milk because I cannot eat well. I only depend on handouts of rice. If I only eat the handouts, how will I produce milk?
Rashida's baby will receive supplementary food each day until she regains her strength and weight. Rashida says if she could receive an income, she'd be better able to care for her children. But Bangladesh's government prohibits the Rohingya refugees from working. And returning to Myanmar, where her family used to have enough food, is not an option, she says.
I'm not going back, because if we return, they will give us trouble again. We need to get our rights first. We are here in Bangladesh for justice. If we don't get it, why will we go back?
The past violence affects the nutrition of babies in another way. Mothers who suffer mental trauma from last year's attacks struggle to properly care for their children.
They have a trauma because they lost their house, they lost their countries, they lost their relatives. When a mother is psychologically affected, mothers don't give proper caring to their babies.
For Rohingya mothers, keeping their children well-fed requires more than food handouts. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Ukiah, Bangladesh.
Happening in Asia, a 17-year-old girl who was set on fire after being raped in eastern India is fighting for her life in a hospital with more than 50% of her body covered in burns, according to health officials. The teenager was attacked Friday after a 16-year-old girl was raped and burned to death in the same state. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. I hope you're doing well today. You're with us on VOA Asia. That's a good start. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Texas Republican Mac Thornberry, told Fox News Sunday he is skeptical North Korea will abandon its nuclear arsenal despite the recent diplomatic thaw and pledges of denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. Thornberry said they may have already conducted enough nuclear and missile tests that they're confident in their capabilities.
Because of sanctions, because of Chinese pressure, because of the president's rather unconventional rhetoric, they may feel a need to have a PR offensive. And I have no doubt their hope is to divide us from our allies in South Korea, to ease some of the sanctions, to ease the pressure coming from China, so that they are not so isolated in the world. I think you can hope for the best, but we have to prepare for the worst. And that means beefing up our ability to defend against missile attack, modernizing our own nuclear deterrent, increasing our defense for ships and other military capabilities in that region. So we have to go into this clear-eyed, but also understand this other battlefield of world public opinion, which is one of the things the president has his eye on.
Sunday, North Korea said its intention to denuclearize is not the result of sanctions or the U.S.-led pressure campaign, and warned against deliberately provoking Pyongyang by deploying strategic assets to South Korea and threatening to raise the issue of human rights in a proposed meeting between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Grant Newsham is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He tells VOA the North statement, notwithstanding, he believes the pressure campaign is precisely what is bringing Pyongyang to the table.
President Trump is the first American president really ever to apply serious, wide-ranging sanctions on North Korea and enforce them. More importantly, he's leaned on the Chinese with the implicit promise of more pressure on Chinese entities that are assisting and bankrolling North Korea. I think this has all led to Kim, his sort of smiling face and his willingness apparently to talk. A willingness to talk, however, should not be taken as a willingness to give up nuclear weapons.
There is some concern amid the comments that the proposed meeting might be dead before it gets underway, which Grant Newsham acknowledges.
Well, that's always possible, but there is a lot of behind-the-scenes discussions that are going on, as I understand it, with the North Koreans. For the Americans to go ahead, there's going to have to be at least a belief that there's some reason to go ahead to have Mr. Trump meet with Kim. And that suggests that topics of all sorts are going to be raised, to include human rights, which scares the daylights out of Kim, given that he runs a gulag state effectively. But all sorts of topics will be raised, I expect, by Mr. Trump if the meeting does in fact go ahead. I'll, of course, believe it when I see it, the meeting. But nonetheless, it does seem as though there is some possibility of at least the two getting ready to talk. But once again, one should not assume that that will automatically lead to progress. Mr. Kim has not a promise really to give up nuclear weapons. There's been the talk of denuclearization, but no specifics really have been offered by the North, and seems that each side has its own interpretation of what that means. And then throw in South Korea into the mix, and it gets even more complicated, given that President Moon does reflect what one would call an anti-American strain in South Korean society that sees the Americans as the problem. And also, he does show an unusual sort of excessive desire to reach a deal of some sort with North Korea. So this is sort of three-dimensional negotiations, maybe four if you throw in the Chinese. And it's going to be complicated, and one shouldn't expect too much until there really is some concrete outcome.
In the wake of Friday's meeting between White House National Security Advisor John Bolton and his South Korean counterpart, South Korean media reports Singapore will likely be the venue for a U.S.-North Korean meeting in June, although other sites have not yet been ruled out. Coming up, Afghan Sikhs and Hindus find a new place to worship here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or Take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. South Korean news outlets say the anticipated summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will likely take place next month in Singapore. Unnamed sources say the U.S. and North Korea have agreed the meeting will take place in the city-state in the third week of June. You have an open invitation to visit VOA Asia Facebook. Stop by anytime. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Afghan Sikh and Hindu faithful have a new home just outside of Washington, D.C. The Asamai Hindu Temple, the first shrine for Afghan Hindu and Sikh followers in the region, opened its doors earlier this month during a festival which is celebrated by both faiths. VOA's Afghan service reporter Muhammad Ahmadi visited the temple. He tells us more.
A traditional Afghan drumbeat officially opened the doors to the Asmai Hindu Temple just outside Washington, D.C., a new focal point for Afghan Sikhs and Hindus who live in the metropolitan Washington region.
This is our own home. Anyone who comes in here can feel comfortable and share their struggles. We can sit together, have open conversations. I can't think of anything better than that.
Located in Silver Spring, Maryland, the temple hopes to attract not just worshippers, it also aims to be the central meeting place for the estimated 1,000 Afghan Hindus and Sikhs who live in the area. Hindus and Sikhs represent a tiny minority of Afghanistan's people.
We are incredibly proud that we all got united.
For worshippers, the temple provides a direct link to their Afghan culture and religion, especially for younger children, many who were born in the United States.
Because the culture here in the United States is different than ours, we try our best to teach our children the history and culture of Sikhs in Afghanistan.
Maryland Congressman Jamie Ruskin, who attended the inauguration, echoed Kapoor's sentiments.
There's a whole new generations of kids, you can see them here today, who've been born here. I think that a lot of the more senior people in the community felt strongly about building a Hindu-Afghan temple so the young people could remain connected to Afghanistan.
Hamdullah Mohib, the Afghan ambassador to the United States, is proud of the community's first temple in Maryland. He promised the embassy's full support, saying the temple serves as a bridge between the community and the Afghan government.
We can now directly communicate with the leadership of this temple, and through them we can reach the community.
Decades of war have displaced thousands of Afghan Hindus and Sikhs, sending them to all corners of the globe. So, for the Afghan Sikhs and Hindus who came here today, the Asmai Temple helps bring all of them a little closer to home. Muhammad Ahmadi, VOA News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
This news from VOA Asia. Australia says Malaysia's interception of a sophisticated people smuggling operation shows its tough policies on human traffickers are justified and working. Malaysia says it stopped a modified tanker May 1st with 131 Sri Lankans, including 98 men, 24 women, 4 boys, and 5 girls on board. You'll find the latest, most interesting stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the future of parenting may see a big change, as scientists and ethicists have a startling prediction about how children will be conceived in the future. VOA's Faith Lapidus has found that biomedical advances, parents may be able to choose a child from hundreds of embryos based on their DNA profile.
A growing number of pregnancies begin like this, in a lab where technicians combine egg and sperm in a petri dish to create an embryo.
That around 10% of reproductive age couples in the United States have trouble getting pregnant or carrying a baby to term, and we don't understand why that is.
With increasing rates of infertility around the globe, researchers like Amanda Clark are exploring new frontiers in reproductive technology. The University of California, Los Angeles scientist and her team are working to convert human skin samples into eggs, which would be fertilized by sperm. The process, called in vitro gametogenesis, or IVG, has so far worked only with mice.
If the technology is proven to be safe and effective, then I think it should be used in specific cases as a way of being able to overcome infertility.
Not only could it address infertility, IVG would be a less medically invasive procedure for women than the current procedure for harvesting eggs.
They'll go to a clinic. The man will give a sperm sample. The woman will give, instead of eggs, a little bit of a skin sample. The cells in her skin will be turned into eggs, an unlimited supply of eggs, and then the eggs and sperm will be combined to make embryos.
That means, in theory, parents could choose which embryo to make into a child based on the genetic analysis. But not everyone expects parents to jump at the chance.
Here in California, where there are some people who would like to have a baby with as few problems as possible, there are many people in this state, and in fact, they're the ones who are having most of the children, who will tell you it's in God's hands.
But even before researchers address safety concerns about testing IVG in humans, its potential is forcing a conversation about the ethics of parents selecting their offspring. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The biggest obstacle on our way towards sustainable energy-based future is the problem of energy storage. Of all the energy generated by solar panels, wind turbines, ocean waves, and other sources, only a small fraction is stored because today's batteries are still not very efficient. VOA's George Pudich has learned a group of researchers from several U.S. and Chinese universities say we should try to mimic nature.
All sources of non-polluting sustainable energy have certain deficiencies. Wind turbines work only when there's wind. Solar cells work only when the sun shines. And the best and also most expensive ones are only about 20% efficient. Boston College professor Dunwei Wang says there's also the problem of long-term storage.
One way to do that would be to connect a solar panel with a battery. But in order to power the entire country or the entire planet, we just simply don't have enough battery materials for this purpose.
But nature created its own solar cells, as well as the method for storing energy. Every single plant leaf uses the process called photosynthesis to harvest energy from the sun, turn it into chemical energy, so-called solar fuel, and burn it or store it for later use. This process is too slow for our power-hungry world. But Professor Wang says a new catalyst could boost the artificial photosynthesis and more efficiently use the sun's energy to split water into oxygen and hydrogen. The latter could be used in fuel cells to produce energy.
What we discovered appears to be one of the best catalysts that can do this reaction. So in other words, we make it a lot easier to extract electrons from water, and in the process generating oxygen, and the electrons can be used to reduce hydrogen, to reduce water to produce hydrogen, or to reduce carbon dioxide.
Further research is required, but scientists say there is hope that the new catalyst could be used on an industrial scale and thus contribute to the general trend towards reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Do you happen to be on Twitter? Many of us here at VOA Asia are. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, my handle is at VOA Stevenson. I post each and every day some of the stories that you hear here, plus many more. So follow me at VOA Stevenson. We also like to let you know that you can find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download our program if you like. And of course, we stream every day on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. We'd like to thank everybody who's listening on the radio. Radioactive Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore carries our program. Thanks to everyone there who's listening. And our thanks, as always, go to Director Tracy Carter, our engineers Zainab Abdel-Rahman, Managing Editor Diane Gal, Skylar Ogden, David Bird, and Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.